Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, Black Don't Crack. On Monday, February 27th, the Neil Marshall Black Culture Center hosted a panel discussion entitled Black Don't Crack. This panel discussed African-American healthcare in the United States. The panelists discussed trust with healthcare providers, along with the history of discrimination against African-Americans in the healthcare sphere. The panelists included Roy James, who is the Director of Student Diversity and Inclusion for the School of Public Health, Rasul Moa, who is an Associate Professor in the School of Public Health, Maria Hamilton Abigunde, who is a visiting lecturer for the African American and African Diaspora Studies Department, and Dr. Lori Thompson, who is a family health physician in Bloomington. The talk was moderated by Shanika Daniels and introduced by Brian Richardson and Monica Johnson. We begin today's lecture with the panelists introducing themselves.
So good evening, everyone. My name is Roy James. I'm the Director of Student Diversity and Inclusion in our School of Public Health here on the IU Bloomington campus. I've been with the School of Public Health since August 2015. Enjoy being here. I've been in higher education administration for the last 10 years, but my master's of public health is actually in epidemiology. And so I've worked in STD clinics on the south side of Chicago, and previously I was on the state's HIV planning group, the board, which oversees and makes sure that the state of Illinois is in concurrence with CDC regulations on the outcome of HIV and AIDS in at-risk populations in the entire state of Illinois. So I've been fortunate enough to, while I've been working in higher ed, to have also positions working within state and community engagement.
It's my turn.
Yes.
How's everybody doing? Good? Good? Okay. Rasul Mowat, I am a professor in School of Public Health as well as the Department of American Studies in the College of Arts and Sciences. In terms of my professional background, I've worked in nonprofits as well as public sector, municipal government. In terms of some of my academic background and some of the focus area that I'll probably be speaking from are impacts of the environment. One of my areas is natural resource management and sustainability. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Maria Hamilton Abigunde. I am the director of the Graduate Mentoring Center in the University Graduate School and a faculty member in the Department of African American African Diaspora Studies. My area of research and work is specifically in memory, trauma, and healing, specifically how it is we transmit intergenerational and historical and ancestral trauma from one century, literally, to the next. My areas of work are in Brazil and up until recently going to Juba, South Sudan. So I'm an on-the-ground person dealing with trauma in its very largest sense, everything from slavery to current genocides. Oh, and I'm a birth and postpartum doula.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Dr. Lori Thompson, and I am a practicing physician here in Bloomington, Indiana. I practice family medicine, which encompasses every age group from birth on up to death. And I've been in practice here for 20 years. I attended Indiana University School of Medicine, as well as an undergrad, and graduated actually though with an undergraduate degree in medical sciences and biology from Indiana State University. And as I said, I've practiced here in Bloomington for 20 years, and I've had the opportunity to see lots of people and manage chronic disease conditions, and that's my main focus, is in managing chronic disease conditions such as hypertension, diabetes, obesity, depression, chronic pain, and that sort of thing.
Thank you for those introductions. We'll begin with the first question. How does perceived discrimination from physicians and public health professionals affect how Blacks view the healthcare system?
So the first question was, how does perceived discrimination from physicians and public health professionals affect how Blacks view the healthcare system? Well, I can say from my own experience, both individually and professionally. A lot of times, we as African Americans are afraid to go to the doctor because we think that they have preconceived notions about who we are and what we're there for. In the past, I know when I was in training, which, you know, I'm a lot older than most of you, and so when I was in training, I remember a lot of physicians looked at African Americans as if they were there for some ulterior motive, seeking disability or seeking pain medicine, narcotic analgesics for a non-medical purpose, or they had other notions that we as African Americans wanted to just be off of work and get a statement and that sort of thing, to be off work, and that we were lazy. And so that affected how a lot of people, that made people of our color not want to go to a physician. There definitely was discrimination there, and there still exists discrimination. And so that made people not want to see a physician, that made them put off diagnoses and ignore conditions that were serious. And so then a lot of times we end up in the emergency department with a serious medical condition that could have perhaps been controlled or prevented.
Where are you going? Okay. We know each other, so it's like, you know. Are you going to go first?
Yeah, okay. All right, I'm going to go big brother sit next to
me. Right. I'm so sorry. We hope you're professional. So I think, you know, one, I want to make sure that I answer the question in relation to how it's phrased. So I don't want to jump to non-perceived discrimination sort of examples. But what we know of in terms of perceived discrimination, especially more recently, there's been a lot more implicit attitudes, implicit bias tests. Are people familiar with the term implicit attitudes, implicit bias? Just in case people are not familiar, it's the whole idea that subconsciously we are sort of all impacted by the society around us that then in turn imparts a sort of response, a very split second response in terms of how we perceive race, but a number of other sort of identity factors. And so one of the things that they've begun to apply is that same implicit attitudes or implicit bias testing in relationship to healthcare systems. So some of the tests, one has been shown to show in terms of emergency care, a sort of delayed response in terms of providing care to somebody who may be coming into an emergency room based upon race, specifically a black person. In other cases, they have done implicit attitudes where it actually looked at the amount of time. So in some cases, I think on average from the study, it was something like 80 minutes for a person who was white to receive care in an emergency room situation, 99 minutes for a person who was black, and 105 minutes for a person who was Latino. In other cases, that more recently, there was an application of implicit bias testing that related to delivery of treatment, so pain, so anesthesia, and so there was the implication there when it gets into the discussion of the study where it was the idea that there was a perception that a black person can sort of resist pain, didn't need morphine or some other type of application. So again, I wanted to be really specific to the question about perceived discrimination. I didn't want to jump into actual forms of discrimination that are obvious. And so the implicit attitudes test that we've begun to see, they've been applied something like around 2010 to about 2016. So if you look for those, that's where you'll see a lot of those health-related uses of that test.
So I think one of the things that we might find this evening is that it's going to sound perhaps that we are repeating each other's words, because there are some, as I think as we go through some of the other questions, that there are some historical factors that shape this question. There's some historical factors that shape the responses of African Americans and African Americans in community to healthcare and how they understand healthcare and how to seek healthcare. So this idea of perceived discrimination that one, because of one's, in this case, because of one's race, right, that one is being discriminated against, right, is important to keep in mind. So that means that we have to think of really broadly what that means in this particular point in time and also historically and how those things have linked. And when I thought about answering this question, there were some things, just three things that came to mind immediately, and how it affects blacks' view of the healthcare system. A lack of trust and or confidence, right? No trust or confidence in the healthcare system at all, right? Even if you have a personal doctor, you go to the doctor so that you can get what you need perhaps, but there's a lack of trust and confidence. And also a fear or a reticence in giving consent, right? And I'm sure that at some point each of us will talk about this idea of consent, right? Or informed consent that is given or not given, right? And how that impacts you. So I will tell you this, that when you go to the doctor, you should read every piece of paper they give you. Recently, IU Healthcare, I noticed something as I was reading, it said something about videotaping and some other things. I said, well, what is that? She's like, oh, we just added that, but we don't ever do that. I'm sure. I said, but how do I know you don't ever do that? Well, you tell me, right? So it is important to read everything, but historically, certain case studies which we're probably all familiar when we get to that point, lead African Americans, and again, I'm saying African Americans and African American communities as if we represent like everybody in that community. That's right. Not necessarily true, right? But just speaking in general, right? And also, it can lead to a disengagement from the healthcare system. Just not being willing to even engage or consider that as an option for you, particularly if you do natural health care. So we're natural health care practitioners and belong to communities of that. If you lack confidence in your system, if you are disengaging from it and you are afraid to give consent, then you may lean more on what it is that you do naturally in your family, which has some pros and some cons to it, because you do need a balance, right? There are some benefits to modern medicine, but historically those have not necessarily always led to the best practices for African Americans.
And only thing that I would add, because I think everyone on the panel has eloquently added to that question, but going back to what Dr. Thompson said, I think we have to keep in mind the historical context when we're talking about perceived discrimination and actual discrimination. So when we think about basic stereotypes that this country or society have for African Americans, how that play in actual accessing, you know, health here. And so if you're perceived to, if you're going to the doctor just to get excused not to be, to be off from work, is that perception that African Americans are lazy. You know, that old stereotype, that trope. One thing that Dr. Moore was referring to, and this is true, when we think about the history of even medical education in this country, there's a recent study they did with University of Virginia medical students about pain tolerance with African Americans. Well, if you think about that, that goes back to when we think about enslavement here in this country. So when we think about when you're a people that's deemed three-fifths human, so it becomes this interesting dichotomy with African Americans historically and even contemporary when we think about stereotypes. Are we superhuman or are we subhuman? Because if we have a high pain tolerance, are we X-Men? You see what I'm saying? So it's one of those things where, so is this a reason why they're not giving black children, you know, opioids, although we already know they're more addictive, but we showcased this in a presentation last week, that when it came to appendicitis and with children, white children were given pain medication before African American children were. So is this, again, the stereotype that black people are prone to be addictive, or that, you know, are we criminalizing, you know, using substances? And so it's one of those things where just keeping in mind that stereotypes are always in the back of the mind also, and they're playing out also.
Thank you. In regards to the concept of perceived discrimination, what exactly do African Americans patients consider discriminatory?
Is it possible that we can expand it to be beyond perceived?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I think, well, the reason why I wanted to get that clarity is because I think that this allows us to sort of open the gates to sort of other discussions if we, you know, because I think we're all trying to be respectful of what's being presented to us, which is, you know, perceived discrimination, but there, you know, once we move beyond perceived, it allows us to deal with, you know, a number of things. And so not to sort of add in something at this particular point, but I think just coming up with some ways to categories to think about where discrimination can originate or be present in. For me, I'm always concerned about access to care. So just physically having a structure whether it's a clinic or a hospital, is that present in proximity to that population of need?
Exactly.
And then not only is it present, so the actual facility, but how open is it? You know, is it open literally 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, or is there a limited time? Because I've worked in communities where it was open like 1 day a week or 2 days a week for 8 hours and something to that effect. But also on the other side of open, is it just when you get in there, now you get into services, right? Are people there able to answer your question, treat you in a certain way before you even get to a nurse, right? Before you even get to a doctor to actually provide the care. So I think there's just all these stages when we think about how we encounter discrimination that you have to sort of run through. Right, so it's not even getting to whether or not the person has asked us for consent, because that's when we finally actually see a physician. You know, it's one, do I have a hospital or a clinic or something around me? Two, is it open in a flexible amount of time that I don't have to take off from work to go to? Three, when I go in there, is there somebody at the front desk? You know, and then if there's somebody at the front desk, will they answer my questions? Do they know how to process me? You know, and then will I have a nurse who will then go through all the proper sort of introductory triage, sort of, you know, taking of my, you know, the basic medicine measurements, and then that gets to training, right? Because how certain things may appear on us as Black people may look very differently than others. I remember talking to a physician that I work with very closely in medical school. They don't really show those images of how rashes may appear on different complexions, right? And so a doctor is unable to even provide a diagnosis because they never seen a rash appear on that color skin in that way. Mm-hmm. So I just want to kind of give those types and pass it out to my colleagues, because I'm sure they can provide some additional insight on that.
Well, I was thinking as you were talking about that in access and affordability, right? Which access and affordability, which then connects to insurance and what insurance is accepted, whether or not you have access to insurance, even given the current market. But I was also thinking what you said in terms of indifference, right? That discrimination, being indifferent to someone is a form of discrimination, and I was. Had an incident where I had gone to a doctor for some time in my HMO, and at the time I was dressed in all white, right? So I was being initiated into a system, an African system, so I was dressed in all white for like 5 years. I'm dressed in all white. I know I'm her only patient who's dressed in all white for 5 years, and I also know that I'm her only Black patient. And so I saw her one day, and it's like, well, hello, Dr. So-and-so, and she looked at me like, who are you? Now, I don't expect you to remember all of your patients, but at least something. So I called the next day and I changed my doctor, right? Because I didn't want that particular person poking me and touching me if they could not, they pretended or acted as if they actually did not recognize me. So discrimination comes in all of these different forms, from the larger structural, you know, aspect, the smaller structural aspects of that, and even beyond that, if you live in a city where the bus transportation does not work, right, or the bus transportation frequently fails, right, and you know where some of those neighborhoods are in the country or in the cities in which we live, that is also a form of discrimination, because then someone is not paying enough attention deliberately to a community to make sure that they have access to multiple levels of care in order to make sure that they remain healthy. So there are a couple of other things, but those were the two things that came to mind.
I always like to look at it from a different perspective because I am a Hoosier. I did a lot of training in rural medicine. And so I like to think about it in a rural perspective. Just think about an African American or a person of color in a rural population, in a rural setting, and how there is such lack of access. As Professor was saying here, that there may be a clinic, there may be a hospital, but are they open at the times where we can attend? Because typically, we don't work traditional jobs, and so therefore, it may not be open when we have access, and we may be penalized on our job if we're not there, and then we may lose our job and not be able to provide for our families. Do we have childcare? Do we have access to childcare so that someone can take care of our children while we are attending the doctor? Do we have transportation? Typically, in a rural setting, you're not going to have public transportation. And so can we get there? Can we afford it? Do they accept our insurance? And typically people of color are going to be on Medicaid or some type of government assistance. And I shouldn't say typically, but that has been the rule in the past. And also just, and there are definitely areas that do not accept certain types of insurance because they are trying to exclude certain populations. And so you have to think about all those things. Those are definite perceived and real discriminatory practices. And then I also look at it, think about a biracial child that's in a rural population. Is that doctor going to understand? Is that healthcare provider going to understand the things that they go through and have to experience as a biracial individual or a multiracial individual in that population and in that setting? And I've had several doctors in the community at times call me and ask me, what would I do with this type of skin, or, you know, have I seen this type of rash or this type of hair condition? That's another thing that we that I get a lot of questions about from other providers, other medical providers, and from patients.
So as everyone had mentioned, definitely we have to look at infrastructure, access, affordability. All of those play a part when we think about health, wellness of individuals. Working on the South Side, just as Rasul had mentioned, and if you think about Chicago, if you all are familiar with the TV show ER, when you use the air and everything, so Cook County Hospital was like the basis for that show, which is now Stroger Hospital. So keep in mind, when we talk about access, it's not even so much as having a nurse practitioner, a primary care physician. Sometimes for a lot of people in Black and Brown communities, either that health clinic, which is run by the Chicago Department of Health, or county health department, which is run by Cook County, and I'm using Illinois as an example, are the main access for health. Depending on what kind of health insurance you have, or lack thereof for health insurance, think about people who go to the emergency room just to access healthcare, which we know, first of all, is not affordable. But a lot of times, that's where we see Black and Brown communities accessing healthcare. And be that you taking yourself or driving yourself, if you can, to the actual emergency room, or a ride in an ambulance, which we know. And we joke about this sometimes. We've seen this in TV shows and movies on popular culture, but that's real. You know, don't call an ambulance because I don't have $900 to pay for that ride. You know, and so I think this is one of those things we have to keep in mind when we talk about how the structure is set up and how people can actually access healthcare. And so that was something definitely have seen. Something else has been alluded to, cultural competency. So everything from when you first walk into that door, from the receptionist to the actual medical care practitioner, how am I being treated in this health setting? You know, is someone greeting me with a smile, or if someone has an attitude toward me, or you can tell whether it's perceived or it is actual, are they being discriminatory toward me? So we think about all these barriers that even stop people from even getting treatment that has nothing to really do about actual your ailment or illness. It's just me accessing is very tiresome. It's very complicated for some people. And it's just one of those things that these are actual barriers that Black and Brown people have to overcome just to access health care.
Can I add in just some additional things? So both related to what Rory and Dr. Thompson just mentioned, so specifically to Indiana, Allen and Joseph, St. Joseph County, Black infant mortality rate is something, incidence is something like over 30 per 1,000, which makes it equivalent to Nicaragua. So that's an example of just some of what you were alluding to, respectively. And these are not the two counties that, of course, that are associated with Gary or, and so on. This is just two other additional counties within the state of Indiana. Specifically, since the question is talking about patients, it's important to also understand what oftentimes also happens in terms of recommendations, follow-up treatment. So in terms of diabetes and hypertension, Black patients are overly represented in terms of receiving some type of amputation or other types of disfigurement as a recommendation of care. So they've already in the care system as all other people are present, but they are more likely to have amputation as the recommendation than all other groups. And that gets us to something that we'll probably keep speaking to, is that the reality that there's health disparities, that there's actual differences in outcomes, is the clear reality that discrimination exists. There's no way that we can sort of see these particular things unless somehow when people come into care, they're not treated properly, they're not viewed properly, or they're not even able to enter the space.
Thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know someone mentioned earlier about trust with the physician. So with the next question, what factors contribute to trust and distrust in physicians among African Americans?
A big one is informed consent, which my colleague and sister here has alluded to. Of course, we have a long history of issues with informed consent, overall in terms of all people encountering health or medical related studies. But of course, we know the classic example for most people here, whoever you go into any type of research course or whatever else, they're always going to tell you about human subjects, and Tuskegee syphilis is always going to come up, as a study that, went well beyond 60 years of looking at the sort of impacts of syphilis untreated in one group, while the other group was a control group who didn't receive any treatment. Well, what was it? One group that didn't receive treatment, another group that received some type of partial treatment. They were looking at the effects of both, and so once that came out in 1972 and started to emerge more and more, that just sort of confirmed the already sort of perceived mistrust, and that has just lingered, and still to this day, especially when it gets into testing of controversial drugs or new drugs, or not looking at the fine line. One of the studies that has not really come out and gotten attention was the Norplant studies in terms of the birth control that was injected into like the arm or the leg heavily in terms of Chicago. They still have sort of not come out with the issues with that, still to this day, but that was huge in the late 80s and 90s, and primarily overrepresented by Black women in that particular trial study. So it keeps coming up, but I just want to sort of put out there that it starts kind of with that knowledge of those things that have occurred, and then it goes into a realm of other things.
Well, definitely there's a mistrust among African Americans in the medical community because of the Tuskegee experiments that were performed, and also because of what was done during slavery. And then also in communities in the 1920s and 30s where doctors were actually killing Black infants as they were born to single mothers who they perceived as having too many children or not being able to provide for these children. And so this happened, and it happened in Chicago. That's the prime area that I am aware of, but also with the Norplant, the situation that occurred. And definitely I remember that's when I was in training, and there was a disproportionate amount of young African American women that were persuaded almost to a point of being just overwhelmingly convinced that that was the best birth control for them, and the only birth control for them, to prevent them from conceiving again in the next 5 to 10 years. And so they were disproportionately persuaded to have this implant done. And so, and I remember that, and without receiving complete informed consent. And definitely African Americans perceive the medical community as such that we don't explain enough to them. And other physicians, white physicians, do not explain things in simple enough terms. Some people are uneducated or just don't understand the terms. And so there's definitely a mistrust there, and they feel like people are trying to convince them to do something that they don't want to do or that could be possibly harmful. The other problem is that a lot of African Americans were not enrolled in good studies. We were doing studies on heart disease and hypertension. They were not included in those studies. So how do we know that that medication that you're recommending is going to work for me and not cause a deadly side effect?
You have been listening to Black Don't Crack on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You have been listening to a panel discussion entitled Black Don't Crack that took place on Monday, February 27th at the Neil Marshall Black Culture Center at IU. The panel talked about African American healthcare in the United States, with topics ranging from African American trust in physicians to the history of discrimination that African Americans have faced in the healthcare sphere. The panelists included Rory James, Rasul Mowat, Maria Hamilton Abegunde, and Dr. Lori Thompson. The discussion was moderated by Shanika Daniels and introduced by Brian Richardson and Monica Johnson. Turn now to Rory James answering a question about trust and distrust in physicians among African Americans.
I think something to add also, and I know this is a shameless plug because I know Dr. Abegunde and Mowat, they're actually going to speak about the Tuskegee, you know, syphilis experiment tomorrow. So, because you all need to come to that if you have not seen Ms. Evers' voice. But, you know, we have to acknowledge, because when we talk about trust and mistrust, and I'm saying this, I am actually an alum of Tuskegee University, so I went there for undergrad and got my Bachelor of Science in Biology. So I chuckle to myself now, because as an African American, when you hear Tuskegee, of course you hear the great history of Booker T. Washington, George Washington Carver, Tuskegee Airmen, in this damn syphilis experiment. And excuse my language for saying that, because when you have a great institution like that, but it's going to go down in history because something nefarious by our own government was conducted in that area, in that town. And so it's one of those things where when you think 50 years later, when I come on campus as an undergrad, we had a health center on campus. And so when we talk about how mistrust still exists and stories we pass down through oral histories or in our families, I didn't want to go to the health center on campus. I'm like, what are they going to do when I get there? And so, you know, was that a legitimate concern? No, it wasn't. They were healthcare workers, you know, there were nurses and there were doctors there, but that still lingered. The ghost of that experiment was there. And I think it's one of those things where if you have a chance, and we brought her on campus last semester, Harriet Washington wrote a book called Medical Apartheid, which talks about everything from Henrietta Lacks to how when we think about the history and specialty of gynecology, you know, the experiments that were done on enslaved African women to get to that, those studies, those things still lingering back. So you had people believing, and as Dr. Moore had mentioned, in the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, medication was withheld. So researchers knew that penicillin would cure and treat these men who were infected. But they knowingly withheld treatment. And so when you get, and Harriet addresses this in Medical Apartheid, so this mythos is created also at the same time. So if they were withholding medicine, were they actually giving syphilis to the subjects also at the same time? So that was something that's in the back of their mind. So we look forward, fast forward, even now, when I was at my previous institutions, African Americans, we don't typically put ourselves down as organ donors because we feel, and some of y'all nodding your head because you may have had that. So if something happened to me or I experienced trauma, are they gonna let me live or are they gonna let me die because they want my organs? And I'm not saying that to spread conspiracy theories, but this is part of the mistrust that exists in our communities because we are creating these narratives. But, you know, there is a level of, you know, truth to it because we know nefarious things have been done to us as communities. And so, of course, that's why we need good public health practitioners, professionals, researchers, and medical doctors to help debunk this. But that, again, it's like these ghosts and these shadows that still exist because of these things that's happened in the past to us as a community.
Yeah.
One of the things that I want to think about, given my area of work, again, is memory, trauma, and healing, and what my colleague there, Rory James, is saying in terms of these things not disappearing, right? These things not disappearing. It's not only that they don't disappear from the historical archive, they don't disappear actually from the actual body archive, right? They don't disappear from the actual emotional archive that we carry with us as human beings. And so in the passing of oral stories, so when Henrietta Lacks's, I believe, son was here and Ms. Gloop were here a couple of years ago, one of the things that we said that in the Johns Hopkins area, Johns Hopkins was the university and hospital that came into possession of her cells and continued to use the cells. But there was reportedly an understanding that no one went to in the area of Johns Hopkins at night because you were likely to be snatched off the street to be used for experiment. That was the story, right? And so again, as Professor Mowat is saying, you know, there is the perceived, there is the actual, but then there are also these memories that are passed from family to family, individual to individual, so that although you may not have experienced it yourself, right? You know that it has happened, and you know that the reality is that it could happen again. And while it may seem to be an irrational fear to someone that you may not go to a doctor for a particular reason, everything in you, so you know when you have a little bit of, you're walking down the street or something happens and you kind of like seize up, right? Imagine that, in fact, this is how you've lived your entire life. And often what I ask people to do is just to kind of clench up their bodies, just kind of clench up their body. I want everybody to try it. Just clench up your whole body, everything, and I want you to hold your breath. And then release. But just imagine that you've been doing that for like 500 years, right? Because of slavery, because of Jim Crow, because of all of these things, then you kind of get a sense actually of what it might be to be African American or Black living all the time. You may, again, perceived, but you know that due to particular types of histories and oppression that perceived, right, can very well become a reality at any moment. And so there's a lot of time spent protecting yourself against this, and some of it is avoidance, like you don't go to the doctor, and then some of it is that you find other ways actually to build trust among other people with whom you have to work. Does that make sense to everyone?
No, I know I mentioned health disparities, and so that's just, again, the differences in health outcomes based upon a certain group. But then there's also health and inequities, which is entirely different, you know, discussion or category, which is just dealing with the differences in health that should be avoidable. So we can look at them and do we see that they're avoidable? When we look at them, are they unfair? Or when we look at them, are they unjust, right? They should fall in those three areas. Well, they shouldn't really fall in the last two, but when we look at them, they can fall in those three areas. So again, avoidable, unfair, and unjust. So there are certain things that we encounter in terms of health that are avoidable, but they may be all on us, right? And, you know, maybe it's because of, you know, just behaviors that I wish to just do on my own, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a slab of ribs over there, and I just sort of consume all the ribs before you all came in. That was not quite healthy, you know, and Rory warned me, like, hey, man, it causes hypertension. I was like, I don't care, right? Like, you know, that's an example of avoidable, right? You know, and so there are health behaviors that are clearly that, right? But when we get into this other realm of unfair and unjust, if everywhere I go, all I'm being served is ribs, mm-hmm. right? That is unfair, right? Like, I want a salad, right? Like can I get it? Like, you know, right, you know, so, right, exactly. And so that becomes unfair. And then unjust is when literally everywhere, not just back at home, but everywhere I go, that's all they're going to give me, right? And so this is what we're kind of getting at, but I'm just trying to give you some useful terms so that when you go and look on your own, you can sort of do your own line of questioning. Where do these things fall in? You know, are they avoidable? Are they unfair? Or are they unjust? Going back to a point that Dr. Thompson mentioned, that we can't, it's hard for us to even think of good studies that Black people have been represented in a significant way. Only one that I can even think of is the classic Bogalusa study that looked at heart conditions that opened the doorway for us understanding obesity. Mm-hmm. And so they're represented very well there, and they were treated very well there. And because of those results, we have a healthy sort of understanding of obesity in current time, not only because of the representation of Black people there, but a healthy representation of white patients within that study, and a small sort of representation of Latinos in that particular study. But that's the only one that I could even think of where, you know, nobody, you know, was untreated, you know, somebody just was left in a room with pizza all their life, you know, whatever else. They were constantly sort of given aid, not only in terms of nurses, but people who were checking their blood pressure every month. I mean, it was constant for like a 30-year period. But yeah, just wanted to kind of share that with you.
And those are some good notes. I'm glad Dr. Mowat mentioned that, because I'm fortunate enough, I went to Tulane for my MPH. Sure. And so the professors in the epidemiology department, we had several of them who actually worked on the Bogalusa heart study. And so, again, another example. But I want to contrast that with when we talk about health outcomes, be they chronic conditions, infectious disease that impact our communities. Even while I was in school in epidemiology, I was known as a pattern. So we have all these studies on cancer epidemiology, you know, nutrition, heart disease, which we know is like the number one killer for, you know, regardless of racial, cultural background. But then what does looking, again, health inequities and disparities, even in grant money and dollars in research?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Food deserts, which was just mentioned by our panelists. So of course you can tell people to eat healthy, eat well, but if I'm in a neighborhood and the only access that I have to food is the corner liquor store, which you can go to Gary, Indiana, Chicago, New Orleans, New York City, Miami, you can go to a lot of major metropolitan areas, and that's the reality for a lot of people. And so when I was substituting in the south suburbs of Chicago, I'm seeing little boys and girls 8 o'clock in the morning eating Flamin' Hot Cheetos. Uh-huh. But think about it, they don't have oatmeal. You know, who's at home cooking oatmeal for them? Toast, bacon. Where are they going to get those groceries if I don't have a car? There's not a Whole Foods in the neighborhood. And so again, we have to talk about inequities and structural, you know, racism or systemic racism, you know, even access to good food. And so we think about the privilege that we have living in Bloomington. We can go to a farmer's market, or we have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. That's not the reality for a lot of Americans. So again, we can talk about, yes, why African Americans are more prone to hypertension or diabetes, but then we also have to look at the reasons why, which contribute to these, you know, disparities or these inequities.
Thank you. Okay. Continuing with the topic of trust, how does the medical trust of physicians and Black women differ from the trust of physicians and Black men?
I definitely see more mistrust from African American men. They definitely have more preconceived notions regarding how they will be treated and received in a medical setting. You know, Black men are seen as being stoic. that they will not tell you where they actually hurt or what the problem really is, because they're afraid that that's going to affect their masculinity, and that they'll be perceived as wimps, or as that they have some kind of problem, or that they're inadequate. And so there's definitely more mistrust there. But also this goes back once again to slavery and how men were treated back then, and demasculinized and that sort of thing. And African American men are afraid of that still. They still have that mistrust and that fear regarding that. And then the Tuskegee, once again, that goes back to that. People in we are very much aware in our population of what happened there. And so there's definitely still more mistrust as far as men versus women. Also, a lot of times we feel in our community that the doctors there are inadequate, because why would they want to practice in a predominantly African American area unless they had some kind of deficiency, or that's the only place that they could practice? Okay, so economically too, we look at that and we think that, well, why do they want to be here in this community, especially if they don't look like us? They must have a problem. They must be deficient. They must not have done very well in medical school or residency or something of that nature, or they must have a record of some sort of. And so there's definitely some perceptions there that lead to more mistrust of the medical community.
So that's a really interesting question for me. I don't inhabit a male body, so, and I'm not a practicing physician, so I don't know. I can tell you that my father is a Korean War veteran, and his experiences with the healthcare system have been quite interesting in the past couple of years, because as he gets older, he's closer to 90. And so the stories that he tells me in terms of the response to him and the assumption, because he is old, but my father actually, I think, is the smartest man in the world, but because he is old and has particular penchants, that the doctors speak to him in a very particular way. He's a natural healthcare practitioner, and so he takes care of himself, right? Mm-hmm. This is a man who, when Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast, right, he was able to survive on his own in all of that madness for quite some time, because that's what he knows how to do. But how he's treated and how he's spoken to is very important to him, because of the assumptions that people make. And he does take a longer time to go to the doctor, because he thinks, you know, believes he can take care of himself, but he knows when to go. I'll speak from this issue more personally, and when thinking about the questions that we were given, I was thinking about modern gynecology, thinking about J. Marion Sims, and thinking about the work that was done, or the torture that was done. One can decide how one can, how one wants to define that for yourself or herself or himself. But the experiments, let's say, begin in the 1840s, 1845, in an effort to solve a medical problem for black women and for white women, in fact, right? A fistula, you know, a break between the walls, between the bladder, the vagina, or the vagina, and the rectum, right? So this causes a lot of pain. It comes from having a traumatic birth, right? So if you think again in terms of slavery, right? So I want you all to just keep in your head that Africans and their descendants were moved thousands of miles to become self-reproducing products, that they were property and they were not human. They were chattel slavery. They can be moved, they could be purchased. Your children and your womb also did not belong to you. They were rented, right? And so the more children you could have, the more wealthy the slave owner would be and more profitable. If you are a woman who has this particular condition, not only is it difficult for you to give birth, you sometimes cannot give birth, and it's certainly painful and smelly and nasty. That's just the reality of it, right? So there's a need to fix this problem because no one's making a product and no one is making profit, right? That's the reality of it. And so several women are used to find a cure or to fix this. One woman, a narc, I believe her name is, over 30 surgeries done. Here's the difference. White women who are operated on are given anesthesia. Black women are not, right? Black women are not. Going back to Professor Moa, the historical context for this is that black people can endure pain more. Black people are immune to pain. Black people don't feel pain. So whatever is done, right, has no bearing on the body itself. So as a black woman going to a doctor, whether I choose a female doctor or a male doctor is really important to me because I come with a whole lot of questions. About a lot of things, but that initial reception that we talked about earlier, right, how you are treated, whether or not you trust, right, the fact that I actually know my own body, that I actually own and am in possession of my own body and I know it well enough to come. I may not know everything, but to come to ask help. And so that if I tell you that I have a lower pain in my right hip, don't try to tell me I don't have a lower pain in my right hip because obviously I'm not walking well today, right? And so that level of trust for many African-American women, is very much tied, again, to more than a perceived discrimination, right, to a historical discrimination that has had major consequences on our understanding as a whole, our understanding of what it means to be female, right, what it means to be safe, what it means actually to be considered to be human, right, and who has access to our bodies, particularly as enslaved women, anyone had access to their bodies. Right? Not only medical profession, but whoever was understood to have papers who said they owned you, whoever they said could sleep with you. So all of those things are important because I work in a field, we were laughing earlier, Brian and I were saying what my area of work is. The body, right? The body is your primary memory source, right? Like if you don't remember it here, this here remembers it. Mm-hmm. Right? And so the way that I think of it in terms of intergenerational and transgenerational memory, so there was a study done a couple of years ago about women who were pregnant in their third trimester in the presence of September 11th, right? The September 11th in New York, right? And that their children, after the study looking at it, and this is a woman who had worked actually with post-traumatic stress disorder for veterans, but they found that the children born to these women had actually inherited those mothers' stress at that particular point. You can look at this in terms of post-memory. Marion Hirsch talks about this in terms of children, first-generation children of Holocaust survivors, right? There's nothing really anybody has ever done to talk about this for African-Americans in this long, very long run. What is it like to be the children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren of people, right, who were enslaved for several centuries and tortured for several centuries.
Sure.
That has a very deep impact on what one's body memory is, right, and how that actually gets transmitted down the line, right? So there's a lot of things, how that differs for us.
I was cautious with responding only in the sense that it just hasn't been, I mean, this question, it hasn't been studied, you know? So let me just rephrase the question to you all so you all know what we're trying to answer as best as possible. You know, how does medical trust of physicians and mental health specialists in black women differ from physicians and black men? And so this is where perception now becomes important, than what's actual, right? So what we know actually, just in terms of certain mental health issues, such as suicide, there is a nationally reported since, like, I think the latest report is like 2015, 2014, there's a decline about 8% for black men. So moving from 10.5 to about 9.7 per 100,000. So they're saying that we are less likely. And then for black women overall, they always have the lowest rate of suicide. Black men ages and black boys ages 15 to 24, it's the 16th leading cause of death in terms of suicide. Of course, once you get older, then it moves like into the late 20s. This tells us like there's not any mental health issues, right? But all of what we've been trying to say is that there's something else happening. I mean, we were just talking earlier about the fact that there was a play that was made, and of course a bad movie that followed it, for colored girls, right? When the rainbow is enough, when the rainbow is not enough. And how is it that this play can have these discussions about the mental health of black women? How Nina Simone can come up with a song called Four Women about, again, the mental health of black women? How is it that we have these perceived stories that have been articulated in all these other ways, and everything that we look at in terms of the CDC and so on tells us that mentally we're okay, and for black men we're getting better, and so this leads us to then you all, in the sense that this is one of these areas that we need, you know, clearly study, because for now, it's only left to those of us who have been impacted by mental health, either because of what we're dealing with personally or because of how it's touched us in some type of way. So this is like police shootings in the 90s, you know, when like they're actually shooting us, right? You know, and then people are like, yeah, right. You know, and now if we say that, people are like, yes, you know, I believe you. Why? Because we have like evidence, right? And so we don't have evidence of what many of us have been perceiving, because there has not been any study to sort of give us the response to this particular question.
You just finished listening to a panel discussion entitled Black Don't Crack that took place on Monday, February 27th at the Neil Marshall Black Culture Center at IU. The panel discussed African-American healthcare in the United States, with topics ranging from the history of discrimination of African-Americans in the healthcare sphere, along with issues going forward. The panelists included Rory James, Rasul Mowat, Maria Hamilton Abegunde, and Dr. Lori Thompson. The talk was moderated by Shanika Daniels and introduced by Brian Richardson and Monica Johnson.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.